Okay. You're not going to get your outline back tonight. In fact, you may never get your outline of the book of Joshua back. That is why I stressed, always turn in a copy, keep the original. If you know you've turned in the original, and there may be a few in here, I think, you may want to ask me for it. But I just wanted to show a few because questions continue to arise as to what's the best format, what works best. This is sort of the standard format, and this works very well for the following reasons. If you look at the little red dot, see, here is the chapter number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And beside the chapter number are short titles running diagonally, so you can really pack a lot of them on there. What you do is, as you're reading through the book, if you use this kind of format, and many people use computers, I'll show that in just a minute. But if you're doing it by hand, and this is a very nice hand, by the way, if you're doing it, not that you have to have one, but it doesn't hurt. If you're doing it by hand, then you can adopt this format, and it really makes it very overview-ish and thus review-ish. You can review the overall shape of the book very quickly. You notice that after, it's even hard for me to read from where I'm standing, but after giving titles to all the chapters, as this individual, male or female, worked through the book, Then he or she, it's actually a she, I might as well admit it, offered a division of the book into larger blocks. Chapters 1 to 5, entering the land of Canaan. Chapters 6 to 12, conquering the land of Canaan. Chapters 13 to 21, dividing the land of Canaan. And 22 to 24, epilogue, which if you wanted to continue in this wonderful parallelism, you could have said, consecrating the land of Canaan or something like that. Okay, but you get the basic idea of how you can analyze the larger blocks of the book very easily according to this kind of system. Then she also offered topics. You know, these chapters mainly dealt with preparation for the conquest. This was the subjugation itself, and then with the dividing and so forth, then the issue is more possession of the land. And that continues right on through the epilogue, in a way. On down, place, Jordan River, Canaan. 2.5 tribes are east of Jordan. The other 9.5 tribes are west of the Jordan as things all settle out. That makes sense. And then she even gives some time frames, you know, about how long these different events took place. So you see, you can get quite a bit on one page. And you could even, if necessary, extend this and analyze it in other different ways. Now, there's no right or wrong way to do these outlines, but this is one good way to do it. Now, let me put another one up there. This is a very similar kind of thing. Again, you see the same basic idea. There are the chapter titles, see, that go across here. Notice how easily you see, if you put the numbers here rather than up here, okay, then you can very easily see what your major blocks are. And he starts with really three major divisions, taking the land, dividing the land, and I can't read that there, aftermath. All right, and then he breaks it down, preparation, conquest, and then more finally a summary in chapter 12. In chapter 13, land not taken, and then the eastern tribes in 14. He mentions Caleb, so forth. He could have, at the end of that, mentioned Joshua, who received an allotment. There's kind of an interesting frame between Caleb and then toward the end, Joshua receiving his allotment, those two spies who had been faithful. But you see that this is basically the same kind of approach. Now, down here, he has done some color coding. A key to literary forms, which was kind of interesting. Historical narrative is in yellow. Poetry is in red. And I don't know if the red is picking up, but these two lines here are red. Just a little bit of poetry there, and territorial descriptions and lists of kings. Okay, territorial descriptions obviously here. So you can see that the historical narrative is very predominant in the first half. Then you get into the allotments, the division of the kingdom, and you have these territorial divisions now, or territorial descriptions. That, whether that's specifically a literary form or not, I think it's very useful to see this kind of pattern in the book, just to show you the kind of variety that's possible. Now, here you have one. Let me zoom back a little bit from this. Well, that's as far back as I can go, so I can't show really the whole thing. Could that be focused better sometimes? Here you have something done on computer. that is very similar in format in one way. You have the chapter numbers and the chapter titles and then the major block divisions of the book. And you see that so far we're getting pretty good consistency. The divisions seem fairly straightforward, 1 to 5, 6 to 12. Now, you'll see that I divide it slightly differently myself for one reason, but that's okay. So you get the idea. Let me look at one or two more just to begin to... Now, here was one that I thought was very, very creative and thus very interesting. I'll just show you part of it. Oops. There's the book of Joshua, and what you have along the top are the chapters with their short titles. And then you have themes. God chooses Joshua with... This is sort of like reading the guide to camping across America or something, you know. Fishing, swimming, you know. It's great, you know. So he goes down and he picks up on these themes that he's discovered. I wish I could read that easier. Reminder to obey the law. And he points out where these occur in the various chapters. And so you get an interesting idea of where themes are repeated. What's this one that goes... Israelite homeland established among... the tribes, Israelite homeland established among the tribes. Okay, there you see that really dominates these chapters beginning in chapter 13. Okay, this is the divisions. And even down here, almost off the page, the seven stone monuments that are raised, and he puts a little number. There's one, there's two, three, four, there's five, and so forth on through. So you can't see all of it, but again, here's a creative idea of trying to get information about the book on one page where you can go back and really understand what the book is about. The only improvement that I would suggest on this one is maybe before getting into this elegant chart on themes, you might want to put in those major block divisions along the top here somewhere so that when comes time to do a Bible content test or something or to be examined in some way or just for your own interest, getting a reminder of the flow of the book, you can look up there and say, okay, well, these are the major blocks. This is the basic outline of the book of Joshua. Okay, let's see. Here's another one working around the limitations of the computer, but I think doing a good job of it. Notice that he has the chapter titles over here, the chapter divisions in the middle, so that he can relate the numbers to the blocks as well as to the specific titles that relate to each chapter. If he had put 1 to 5 over here, you might have had to do some tricky eye work or guesswork to remember, is this 1 to 5 or what? So I like juxtaposing the numbers of the chapters both to the titles and to the descriptions of the major blocks. Now, some of you may think, oh, okay, I can improve next outline. I know you're turning in, what is it, Judges tonight. But if you see ways that you can improve your outlines, by all means do so. I've looked through these. They're fine. But you could improve them in places, just little simple things like that. Or maybe sometimes a little more detail in terms of the divisions. You may want to struggle a little more to analyze the book a little further than maybe very simple divisions. Okay? I think that's where I was going to... Oh, this one I like because it had color on it. I don't know if you can see the color there or not, but again, this is working with a computer system and doing the same thing. This might be improved by perhaps bringing these numbers over here, you see. So again, you could relate them both to chapter titles and to then the major divisions, although this is so cleanly laid out, it's not very hard to follow that across. Okay, so that's fine there, and you have the nice colors. Okay. All right, any comments or questions on that? Why didn't you project mine? Well, you know, it's just I'm being pretty arbitrary, okay? But maybe this will give you some ideas. And I encourage you to make that a big part of your learning process, because we're covering a corpus. I haven't measured this per se, but I told you this before. As a general rule, we cover in this course a corpus as large as the New Testament. So we won't be able to creep, you know, verse by verse through the entire thing. And for you to get a handle on Bible content, a lot of that work is going to be done on your own. Now, we'll talk about certain events and certain things and go into depth on some of them, but it's good if you develop the framework through your own reading and outlining of the books. Okay? All right. Yes, question. Right, yeah. If you don't get a return missive from me, then you're doing fine. Okay? And I'm going to have my grading assistant actually go through these and record that, yes, you did do them. And if he spots anything yet, he may send one back. I'm going to give him the liberty to see if he can see improvements as well, because I work through them fairly quickly, and I let him do it a little more slowly, see if he sees something that's an improvement. Okay? It's so tempting to point at you with this, you know, but I won't do that. All right, well, let's do this. Let's go ahead and take... No, I tell you what, let's just stop here for the moment and remain seated. I'm thinking on my feet whether we should take a little break here or not. Let's stay. We haven't really gone long enough to take a break. Let's just stop here a minute. I'll let him stop the tape. We'll turn the lights back on. Okay, now we're going to continue in our discussion of the book of Joshua. Before we actually launch into that, though, I want to do one of my favorite things, and that is to review with you, orally, the kings of Israel and Judah. I want this on tape because I want the viewer at home to do this kind of thing so that they learn it as well. It's part of the course, okay, and it'll help. All right, if you have your sheet, you can look at that. If not, just look at me and read my lips, and we'll try to learn these things. So first of all, the kings of Judah, Judah being the southern kingdom. The division of the kingdom takes place in 1 Kings chapter 12. You'll learn that if you don't already know it a little bit later in this course. And the first that we drill, the way we begin, is with Rehoboam. All right, now remember we have hand motions that go with this, because there are 3 in the 10th century, 5 in the 9th, 5 in the 8th, 5 in the 7th, and 2 in the 6th, bringing the grand total of kings of Judah to 20. All right, so shall we do that together? Now remember, you have to keep... You can just watch my hand motions. It might be too complex to try to do. I'll get mixed up, but don't you try to do this at home, okay? Just do the drills, learn the drills. But remember, it's 3-5-5-5-2, and then you can keep them roughly organized according to century. So first of all, the kings of Judah: Rehoboam, Abijah, Asa, Jehoshaphat, Jehoram, Ahaziah, Athaliah, Joash, Amaziah, Azariah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah, Manasseh, Ammon, Josiah, Jehoahaz, Jehoiakim, Jehoiachin, Zedekiah. If I babble on, then I would be a liar. I love getting mature adults to do that. It's so much fun. All right. Now, the kings of Israel, the northern kingdom. Again, there are 20 of these. By the way, I did say the kings of Judah. There was one queen in there, Athaliah. So the kings and queen of Judah, to be perfectly accurate. Now, the kings of Israel, again, there are 20, and they are 3, 9, 8. Okay, so 3 in the 10th, 9 in the 9th, 8 in the 8th. It all makes good sense. Don't watch my hands, because I'm... Okay. All right, so beginning with Jeroboam, and again, remember, there are 2 Jeroboams. There's Jeroboam the first, Jeroboam the second, who comes in the 8th century. So, Jeroboam, Nadab, Baasha, Elah, Zimri, Tivni, Omri, Ahab, Ahaziah, Jehoram, Jehu, Jehoahaz, Jehoash, Jeroboam, Zechariah, Shalom, Menachem, Pekiah, Pekah, Hoshea, then came Assyria and took them all away. Okay? All right, good. I do encourage you to practice that at home. It will be useful at a later date in the course. In fact, I will possibly, on one of your tests, ask you to put either the kings of Israel or the kings of Judah in relative order, one to another. Or I may ask you to distinguish which are kings of Israel, which are kings of Judah. So I do want you to learn that, and I'm just trying to make it more fun than it otherwise might be. Okay? All right, now we come back to talk about the book of Joshua, which we began talking about last time. And just by way of quick review, if I can find my nifty outline here, we began by talking again about reading method and how we should dive into a book like this, how it was important to learn to stop and listen and to ask questions, to be very attentive to the text, and then to reflect on the questions we've asked. Go ahead and try to find answers to some of the questions we asked using the tools that are available, tools like Bible dictionaries and concordances, of course, cross-references in study Bibles, and best of all, our own reading of the text. Then we mentioned the necessity of reading holistically. In order to get the most out of a book like Joshua or a book like Judges, you really need to get a sense of the flow of the book, and that's one reason we do the outlines, to kind of know where the whole thing is heading. Now we want to move on and talk about the broad sweep of the book. You have a sense of this already from your outline. As we were looking at the outlines on the overhead earlier, we do get the impression that most people are seeing essentially the same thing in this book, and that's comforting. If everyone saw something different, we'd wonder if anything was actually there to be seen or whether we were just using our vain imaginations. But we basically see the same thing as we look at this book and what its major divisions are. If you will look at the outline that I handed out, again, this is not a better outline than yours. It's not the one you should use for getting familiar with the book more than yours. This was just my own attempt to subdivide the book in ways that were meaningful to me. But I want to use it as a way of more or less working through the book and just making a few comments along the way. So we'll take this broad look at the book, which is about all that we tend to have time for in these courses, which do survey a great deal of material. If you look at the major divisions first, I've done something maybe a little innovative in that I've divided off chapters 1 to 6 rather than 1 to 5. In other words, I've taken the preparations in 1 to 5 and included with that chapter 6, which recounts the fall of the walls of Jericho. And I've entitled that whole thing, The Conquest Initiated, specifically The Conquest Divinely Initiated, because God is at work here. He gives that first victory. In fact, it's entirely His victory. We'll come back and talk a little more detail about each of these sections, but I just want to outline the overall sections in the book. Then at chapter 7, because of Achan's sin, we find that the conquest is humanly mitigated. That's sort of a $10 word that was necessary to rhyme with initiated. So it means that it is impaired, it is hindered, it is somehow jeopardized by the sin of Achan. So what was divinely initiated is now humanly mitigated, and it remains so until God begins to encourage His people. They find themselves having to pay a price for their sin in chapters 9 and 10 as they go out and actually fight for a Canaanite city, which they should have been at that point dispossessing. And then we come to chapter 10:29, middle of chapter 10, through the end of chapter 12, the conquest divinely consummated as God brings the thing together and enables His people to conquer the land that He had sent them in to conquer. Then turning the page, chapters 13 to 21, the conquest allocated. Fairly complex little bit of outline there, trying to see what was allocated to whom and how. I wouldn't encourage anyone to try to memorize those precise divisions there. I was just kind of summarizing the allotments to the different tribes. You can pick up on what those tribes are in that middle section, 14 to 19. And then chapters 22 to 24, the conquest consecrated. And I've included 22 in there, which is that altar of testimony. Some people like to include that with what preceded, but I think it fits nicely there as well. Okay, any questions or comments about those overarching divisions? I think they're quite similar probably to what you discovered. At least most people would see 1 to 12 as the conquest proper, and probably the first half of that, or 1 to 5, as preparation for it, and then the actual conquest itself. And then 13 to probably 21 as the conquered territories allotted to the various tribes, and then an epilogue of some sort. So I've just summarized it under conquest initiated, mitigated, consummated, allocated, consecrated. And by making those rhyme, maybe it makes it a little easier to remember. Now let's go back and talk about these sections a little bit more, and also let me just let you view my corny at times chapter titles. But again, I was just trying to find a way to make them memorable to me in a way that it makes it easy to remember what happens where. In chapter 1, as we talked about at some length last time, Joshua receives his charge from God. That is, he receives his commission. Moses, my servant, is dead. Now, therefore, you do this. So, in chapter 1, Joshua receives his charge. In chapter 2, he begins to take charge. He begins to act on that charge he has received. He sends out spies. And there's a question that I raised last time as to whether he was acting strictly on God's orders in sending out those spies, or whether he may have been doing what had been done before. There's always a danger that we will do what is habitual. He had been a spy. He had spied out the land himself. Whether God ordered him to send out these spies, the text really doesn't tell us. We do discover later, as I also mentioned last time, that the next time he sends out spies, he comes to grief as he sends out spies to the city of Ai. And they come back and say, shouldn't be a problem. We don't even all have to go up. Just send a few up. We can take care of that little place. And they suffer a defeat. They suffer defeat because of the sin in the camp, and God is not with them, and thus they are defeated. So maybe there's, it's a question about human initiatives that are not divinely directed. We do know at least later that Joshua makes an agreement with the Gibeonites that specifically, according to the text, was not divinely directed. Is this to be a subtle hint of that, that maybe that could happen even in the life of Joshua? Maybe, I'm not sure. It's one of those literary gaps that is not easy to fill. Well, then in chapter 3, we have the Jordan crossing and struggling to come up with a title that would seem similar to the next one. I said, the waters stacked up, and they were stacked up like a pile up there at Adam, at the town of Adam, as we were mentioning before. And then in chapter 4, we have the record of the memorial stones that were set up to commemorate the crossing of the Jordan. And this crossing of the Jordan begins to underscore the way in which this entry into the land of Israel is very similar to the exodus out of the land of bondage, out of Egypt. Just as God had brought Israel out of Egypt, being led by Moses, now Joshua is, as it were, a new Moses. He was Moses' aide. He is now, Moses is dead. Now Joshua is to take the leadership. God had groomed him for that. And many have noted that there are traits here that establish Joshua as kind of a second Moses. He's described on that mosaic pattern. And in those little shadow boxes you see on the right-hand side of your outline, I show that I try to highlight the ways in which Joshua is a little bit like Moses. He was charged to replace Moses. He was exalted like Moses. You remember at the end of chapter 1, the people said, we will obey you as we obeyed Moses. You know, only be strong and courageous. And God, in chapter 3, does establish Joshua's credibility, and the people obey him as they had obeyed Moses. And we'll see then as we come to chapter 5, which I entitle Ritual Renewal, Divine Encounter. There are really a couple of things going on there. Israel is circumcised, having neglected that in the wilderness. The people are circumcised, and it says there that the reproach of Egypt rolled away at Gilgal. A nice little touch there, because the city of Gilgal comes from a Hebrew word, galal, which means to roll. And so this is the place of rolling. And the narrator makes good use of that place name to say, you can remember what happened here, because remember, the town means to roll, and this is where the reproach of Egypt was rolled away. Well, what would the reproach of Egypt have been? What in the world is that talking about? That's not a rhetorical question. If anyone has a comment, what would the reproach of Egypt possibly have been? Yes? Okay, the fact that they were going to go out to the desert to die. I mean, here these people had been dramatically delivered from Egypt by this God who held up to mockery the gods of Egypt and demonstrated his power and everything else. And then they'd been wandering around, and the whole generation, but for a few, had died in the wilderness. And you can imagine the Egyptians, smarting with pain from what they had suffered, were taking some delight in the reproach that they could now heap on these people. Hey, they were better off back in Egypt. Now they're out there dying in the wilderness, and they're saying that themselves. Now, we don't know that they knew what they were saying exactly, but you can see how Egypt would have scoffed at them and reproached them. Well, this is an appropriate juncture, as Israel has now crossed the Jordan into the land of promise at last, that this cutting rite, this circumcision of the people, reestablishing, taking on the sign of the covenant again, reestablishing that covenant with God, is seen to roll away the reproach of Egypt. They can't laugh anymore. We have arrived. Likewise, the Passover is celebrated, and the manna, which had been provided in the wilderness days, stops. Okay, you're now in a land flowing with milk and honey. That special provision is no longer necessary. Now, at the end of chapter 5, something very interesting takes place, beginning in verse 13. Let's look at this a minute. Someone raised a question about this after class last time, and occasionally as we work through this outline, I want to pause and reflect upon something in the text or ask about it. This is again one of the aspects of the experience of Joshua that does remind us of Moses, particularly the business about take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy. Sounds very much like what was said to Moses when he encountered the burning bush that was not consumed, and God spoke to him from the bush. Now, beginning in verse 13, this is what we read. Now, when Joshua was near Jericho, he looked up and saw a man standing in front of him with a drawn sword in his hand. Joshua went up to him and asked, "Are you for us or for our enemies?" "Neither," he replied, "but as commander of the army of the Lord, I have come." Then Joshua fell face down to the ground in reverence and asked him, "What message does my Lord have for his servant?" The commander of the Lord's army replied, in essence, "I'm not coming to bring you a message. I'm coming to impress you with the fact that God is at work here. Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy." This is something that kind of reinforces my wonder or my suspicion as to whether Joshua should have been information gathering. You know, he sent out those spies initially. Now, these are very tentative thoughts, by the way. He sent out those spies, and now he's saying, "What's the message? You know, what is the stratagem? You know, this is God's messenger. What are you going to tell me?" And he says, "All I'm telling you is to take off your sandals. The place you're standing is holy." Now, another reason I want us to look at this is it is a bit perplexing in verse 13 when Joshua asks, "Are you for us or for our enemies?" And the man replies, the messenger replies, "Neither." Now, what does that say to you? It sounds like he's saying, "I'm nonpartisan," doesn't it? "I'm not for you, I'm not for the Canaanites." But does that make sense? It does? In what way? Okay, all right, yeah. But is he... The answer was that his assignment was to carry a message. No more than that. But now, does that... When I read the NIV and it says, "Are you for us or for our enemies?" It sounds like he's saying, which side are you for? Who are you for in this battle? Now, God was for his people and against the Canaanites, whose iniquity was full. Okay, and we'll talk about the genocide of the Canaanites next week and get into that sticky, wicked, ethical question. But what do you think's happening here? I think it's a very simple thing. Does anyone have another translation that makes this makes more sense? Yes, Peggy, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Again, no. What is the question posed? Okay, NRSV is the one I like better. Do you have the NRSV? Okay, another version. That was the NAS? We've had... Okay, the question is, yeah, I was wondering if there's another translation that does that. Here's where a little reading of a commentary, or if opportunity knocks, taking of Hebrew will help you. And I'm not sure why this has been overlooked, but... In Hebrew, the question could just as well and perhaps better be phrased, "Are you with us or with them?" In other words, Joshua sees a man. It says he describes him as a man. Now, he may not have known that he was a divine visitor here, but he sees a man standing in front of him with a drawn sword. Now, what's the first thing you're going to ask in a military situation? Whose side are you on? Are you one of my troops or are you one of their troops? Are you ours or theirs? And that's all he's asking. You know, are you ours or theirs? And so the guy says, "Neither. You know, I'm not one of your guys, and I'm not one of their guys. It's not that I'm nonpartisan. I'm coming to you because God is for his people. But I'm God's man. I'm not your soldier." You see? Simplifies the text greatly and causes it to make sense. Yeah. Elaborate. The question is, could it be in any way redemptive, looking forward to Christ? Okay, because Christ came to die for all people, not just the Jews. I would be wary Surely, in a way, this prefigures Christ. You know, the messenger of the Lord, in a way, prefigures Christ. Remember, that is discussed in your reading in Howard. Okay, and he basically comes down very kind of tentatively, not wanting to identify the angel of the Lord as a pre-incarnate manifestation of Christ or Jesus necessarily, but clearly as a manifestation of God in some way, which does foreshadow the incarnation in some way. So there's a lot of mystery there as to exactly how to understand the angel of the Lord. And in that general sense, but I would, you know, my sense is to be a little wary of saying that the significance of this encounter is that the angel of the Lord, or the man, the messenger of the Lord standing there before him, is making that kind of broad, sweeping theological assertion that I haven't come for you only, but for all the world. I think it's probably simpler than that. And if there's a simpler solution, then it's probably the one to choose. And I think Joshua just saw a man with a sword in his hand and quickly wanted to determine, do I need to draw my sword? Are you ours or theirs? And he said, neither. I'm not from either army. I've come to you as captain of the hosts of the Lord. Yes, in the back. Bill. Right. Yeah. Well, actually, Ai comes later, but I think he's making that kind of point right now. You know, Joshua, you've been gathering information. You've been charged to take these people in to inherit the land, but don't begin to think it's your work. You know, it's kind of like when we're sent into a particular task, or we're given a job in the church or something in the community where we feel like we're God's commissioned workers in this particular field. We begin to strategize and so forth. But God occasionally needs to remind us, wait a minute, you're not going to accomplish this on your own. This is not your work. It's not going to be your clever strategies or your planning or your education or your having taken so and so many evening courses at Covenant Seminary. It's my work, you know. And so you need to take off your sandals and recognize you're on holy ground. I will do my work as you trust me. And it's very striking that the first victory, which is chapter 6, the walls fall because God is faithful, that first victory is entirely God's doing. Well, I say entirely God's doing. They had to go up once the walls fell. They had to go in and actually take the city. But they didn't batter the walls down. They didn't think of a clever ruse by which they could get inside the city and defeat it. God defeated the city, and all they were responsible for was the mop-up operation. Yes, another question over here.
I was thinking,
right. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I think that's very to the point. He's making the point that the issue here is agendas. The enemy has an agenda. Joshua probably has an agenda, but that's really not the issue at all. God has the program. God is the one who is to direct our steps, and I think that's a good lesson that we need to learn as we embark on any, you know, kind of adventure or any task that we've been called upon to do, to recognize that really it's God's work. It's God's work. And as we look at chapter 6 and what went on there, imagine yourself as an Israelite thinking, okay, you know, in many kinds of encounters, they talk about the importance of a first impression. And I know it's not popular to use sporting illustrations with women, but I think women are often better athletes than men, so with your patience, I'll do that again. But often, you know, when you're sent into a game, the coach will say, you know, you get the first knock in, you know, particularly in football. You fire off the line that first time, and you show him you mean business. Don't let him knock you backward. You knock him backward, and that'll set the tone. Okay, so you can imagine the people coming in, we're going to take this land, we better impress them. You know, and they probably had all kinds of ideas about what they were going to do. Joshua had sent spies particularly to Jericho. They wanted to find out particularly how Jericho was vulnerable, what could be done there, and so forth and so on. Now, good came out of it, as one of you mentioned last time. Rahab was discovered. She expressed faith. She ultimately joined the lineage that would ultimately issue in Christ himself. So good came out of that spying mission. But none of it was necessary, because Joshua didn't need to know a thing except to follow orders, which had him walking or marching around the city in some kind of procession for 6 days, and then on the seventh day marching around seven times and then blowing the trumpets and shouting, and the walls fall. Now, you can imagine that seemed ludicrous to the soldiers. You know, I can just hear them going, what are we doing, you know? I'm getting tired walking around this city. I'm going to be exhausted by the time we get to any fighting. You can imagine it didn't mean much to them. It was probably seemed crazy. Well, you know, again, sometimes what God calls us to do seems crazy at the time. Now, it's possible that that what they were doing meant a great deal to the city of Jericho. And I hate to keep saying it's possible, and this is a tentative idea, but maybe that's the nature of trying to figure out some of these things. And we can't be absolutely sure, but there's a man named David Livingston who talks about a ritual that is known, or at least a ritual text, or a mythological text that is known from Ugarit, which is a city just north of the land of Israel today. Ugaritic culture would have been pretty pervasive in the land, and I can't get into all the details, but he links this particular story, this myth, up with the city of Jericho. Jericho, Yariach, means the city of the moon, okay, and so it could have been linked with moon worship. But at any rate, he talks about how this particular story involves a king named Keret going on a 7 days journey to another city in order to then stand below the walls and shout to the king that he might be given the king's daughter in marriage because he is without wife. I can't remember all the details of this Ugaritic legend. But to shout to that king on top of the walls, and the culmination is the king agrees and gives his daughter's hand in marriage and everything is wonderful and good and right. Now, it's possible, just possible, that those inhabitants of Jericho might have gone through some kind of ritual reenactment of that story, maybe on an annual basis. Now, again, all this is hypothetical. He's written an article on it, so blame him. But imagine that that is the case, you know, that on an annual basis they would get out and they would reenact this 7-day journey. They would march around their own city and then they would call out to the walls and the daughter would be given by the king, and there would be a great celebration and all would be right with the world. Maybe God knew, and maybe God had his people do that to say something very sobering to the inhabitants of Jericho and really to hold up their God to mockery. It appears that God did that when he brought the people out of Egypt. Some of the plagues that he sent are understood to be holding up to mockery the gods of Egypt. And the text actually says that that's what he did. So it's the kind of thing that God might do to make a point. So what may seem nonsense to us and seem like it's not communicating a thing to us may be very significant to those who are watching us and seeing what we do. So it's very important that we recognize, you know, it's not our work, it's not our agenda, it's God's work, it's holy ground, he will do it, all we do is obey, all we do is trust and follow and do what he says. Now we're going to take a break here take a 10-minute break. We'll make it when the big hand reaches the 4, which is a 12-minute break. So let's just take 2 minutes if there are any questions, or 1 minute. If there are any questions that you want to ask, go ahead and pose them now. We'll pick up when we come back with the conquest humanly mitigated. I see more people interested in break than questions, so we'll go ahead and take that break. Come back when the big hand reaches the 4, please.